From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast episode 52 for Friday, the 18th of November, 2011. It's our 52nd episode and 1 year to the week since we started the Wired.co.uk podcast. Back then, it sounded like this.
It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 2 for Friday, November 12th, 2010.
Ha, nice audio quality, bro. Anyway, on a quasi-special show this week, we're going to re-explore some of the trends we've looked at over the last 12 months and bring in a whole host of special guests to talk to us about how those same trends are going to evolve over the next 12 months. And to celebrate, what the hell, we're going to give away an iPad 2. So listen out for that. But before that, it's time to get our hats on and our nog out as we celebrate this week in Wired News.
Nog?
Nog?
Eggnog.
It's not Christmas.
It's close to Christmas. Almost season's greetings. I'm Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me, as always, Duncan Gear.
Bah, humbug.
Sorry, and of course, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
It's been a whole year, guys.
It's not Christmas yet, though.
No, I know.
According to Tesco.
Getting way too excited.
There was some confusion, apparently, over my intro that, you know, what's nog? It's eggnog. Christmas. It's almost Christmas. It's our anniversary show. We're supposed to be celebrating. It doesn't actually seem that long since our first episode. I remember when Duncan said
hello,
and when Liv said
hello
for the first time. Has the year passed okay for you guys?
It's been all right.
It's been, yeah, delightful.
Happy. So we're going to give away an iPad at the end of the show, so listen out for that. You'll have to pay a little bit of attention to our feature as we go through the show today to answer a question. So, I don't know. Keep listening. So we're going to do some news anyway first, which is the world's first lab-grown hamburger has been grown, and it costs almost £250,000. Duncan?
It's going to be grown. This is Mark Post, who's a vascular biologist at the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands, who I think the magazine covered a couple of years back, but his latest work is to create a proof-of-concept lab-grown hamburger, and he reckons it's going to cost in the region of €250,000 to assemble.
Apart from, you know, the killing of beasts, what's wrong with our hamburgers? Why do we need to replace them with labs?
Well, what's wrong with our hamburgers is that they use an awful lot of energy, they emit a huge amount of greenhouse gases, and they take up loads and loads of land.
Not the hamburgers.
Well, no, but growing the meat that goes into the hamburgers. And that's a problem. So what Post has done is he's built these kind of like muscle strips. Now, they're made from stem cells harvested from leftover material from slaughterhouses. And then he builds up these strips layer by layer by layer with some lab-grown fat in as well, till there's 3,000 of them, and that resembles a burger.
What sort of texture do these things have and taste?
Well, and is this a burger? Is this a beef burger or is it a chicken burger a beef burger?
It's a lab-grown meat burger, so it's not entirely sure. But
stem cell burger.
It's a stem cell burger, exactly. But he hasn't actually tried eating one yet. But because there's no blood in the flesh, it doesn't actually look much like meat. It looks a bit more like sort of scallop flesh, white and slightly translucent.
They're going to have to work on that if that becomes a kind of commercialized proposition.
So definitely. But they act just like real muscle, in that if they're not exercised, then they waste away. And so to remedy this, when Post was growing these strips, he had to stretch them between two Velcro sort of tabs in a Petri dish to provide a resistance to their natural tendency to contract and let them build up strength.
So gross.
I'm so not hungry.
But actually, if this sounds really gross initially, but then you think of things like crab sticks, which have absolutely no resemblance to the real crab.
And even a sausage,
I love them.
You know?
Hey, steady.
Yeah, don't diss the sausage.
But the point is that if we are able to grow meats in vitro, that uses up to 60% less energy, emits nearly 90% less greenhouse gas, and uses 98% less land than regular animal meat. So with a kind of rapidly growing global population that's got a taste for meat, especially in fast developing countries like India and China, it might be that kind of land factor might be the most critical aspect of all.
And presumably we'll be able to make these kind of uber meats that are super healthy and super lean and super nutritious.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, obviously we're not talking about steaks here. We're at a very, very early stage, and processed meats like sausages and chicken nuggets and things like that are going to be much, much easier to replicate than a lamb chop, for example, which has a much more nuanced texture. So an early goal, as you say, is to kind of make these processed meats much, much healthier, using less saturated fats and more polyunsaturated fats and, adding nutrients and vitamins and so on.
Do we have any kind of a time frame about when we might be able to see these on one of our plates?
Well, he's hoping to
knife and fork.
He's hoping to have the burger together, I think, within the next year or so, and then from there it'll be probably another 5 or 6 years. So we're not really there yet.
But it's a long time to wait at chef's table.
It is,
and like all experimental foods and all experimental things that I put in my mouth, I want to see someone else chew it before I do. Let's move on. Battery redesign could lead to 15-minute charging times. A set of engineers from Northwestern, which I think is in the US somewhere.
Yeah. Northwestern United States.
Yeah, and they reckon that they can build a battery that charges 10 times faster and lasts 10 times longer than the current lithium-ion batteries. And lithium-ion batteries and lithium-polymer batteries are the kind that you see in the iPad and in your laptops and in your phones and things like that. They've been around for a long, long time, and battery development hasn't been anywhere near as fast as processing power development for things like CPUs. We've just become much more efficient. Basically our devices have just got much more efficient at how they suck little bits of battery. The thing is, Duncan, as cool as this is, and they reckon it could be on the market within the next 2 to 5 years, I don't actually understand how it works.
Well, existing batteries kind of trap lithium between carbon-based graphene sheets, and these carbon sheets can only actually hold one lithium atom for every 6 carbon atoms. And people have been trying for a little while to use silicon as a replacement, because silicon can hold 4 lithium atoms for every one... No, yes, 4 lithium atoms for every one silicon atom. And so engineers have been experimenting with silicon, but the problem with silicon is it dramatically expands and contracts when it's charging, and that fragments it and the battery kind of falls apart very quickly. You don't have batteries that last very long. So what they've done is they've used sheets of silicon, but instead of making it continuous, they've punched little holes about 10 to 20 nanometers wide in the graphene, and that gives the silicon a kind of a room for it to expand and contract. And it also has the side benefit of introducing kind of shortcuts for the ions to go from the anode to the cathode, and means that that kind of increases the charging time.
Could these batteries be used for electric vehicles, or are they specifically for kind of smaller devices? Or
as far as I'm aware, I think they can be used for anything. I mean, it's just a new type of battery.
Because that's a big challenge for electric vehicles, is the charging time. It takes so blooming long that it's a pain.
And capacity too.
Yeah.
I think the Tesla, is it the Tesla Roadster, uses like dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of lithium ion batteries.
Yeah.
You know, which are very, very similar to the kind that we use in laptops and take forever to charge. So 2 to 5 years, we hope.
We hope.
We hope. Well, one way we may be able to charge these batteries will be by harvesting the power of the ocean. Duncan, courtesy of France.
Yeah. From next summer, I think it is, the French coast near Paimpol-Bréhat in Brittany will be home to the world's largest tidal energy plant.
And this has been in construction for a while, I believe.
Yeah, the plan was originally conceived in 2004, and construction began in 2008, but it's next summer that the plant is actually due to come online. It's hoped it's going to provide power for up to 4,000 homes in the area, and it's going to cost something in the region of 40 million euros.
And it's the biggest one of its kind in the world.
In the world, at the time it's going to be built. I think there's bigger ones kind of in construction at the moment, but when this one is finished, it will be the largest. It's going to consist of just 4 turbines, but they're 2 megawatts each. They've got a huge diameter of 22 meters. They sit on the seabed 35 meters below the surface of the sea, and each of them weighs 850 tons.
Now, in our story, it's mentioned that this is actually a much more predictable way of producing power, because you don't have to rely on things like, you know, stronger winds and things like that.
Yeah, that's the chief benefit of tidal power over, say, solar or hydroelectric or wind. Solar, hydroelectric and wind all depend on the weather. They depend on the sun, rain and the wind, respectively. And so the benefits of tides is that we know what the tides are going to be doing in 10 years' time. We know what they're going to be doing in a week's time. We know what they're going to be doing in 3 months' time. They're very, very predictable. And so we know exactly how much energy is going to be generated, and we can compensate for that.
Okay, so you've got these enormous turbines in the sea aren't these just going to liquidize all of the fish?
No, they've actually been built with a huge, great big open center to allow marine life to pass through happily without getting caught in the blades. And there's no oils or greases involved in the construction either, so there shouldn't be any pollution. And apparently it produces very little mechanical noise too, so it shouldn't disrupt local ecosystems too much.
And best yet, you can't see it from the surface because it's under the sea.
Yeah, they're invisible. So you don't get not in my backyard syndrome, NIMBYism. And it's just, it seems like a great idea.
It can't be much fun to fix if you do get, like, you know, a whale stuck in it.
Sorry, I just got a wonderful mental image.
So did I.
No, I don't think, I think that might be a bit more difficult, but I suggest that, I suspect that you'll be able to hitch a rope to it and pull it up from the seabed.
Or put some whale repellent on it.
Or whale repellent, yeah, indeed.
Fair enough. Well, let's talk about bikes. We have spoken about it in the past, but Liv, as a cyclist, this one is one for you, I think. This is like Air Miles for bikes in London.
Yeah, it's a really cool company, a new startup called Please Cycle, which is trying to provide a way for companies to kind of gamify their employees' commute. So what it does is, like, each company will get its own sort of cycle hub, basically kind of a web app, and individual employees who cycle can download a little application, a GPS application, that will chart all their little journeys on a bike. And these can kind of add up, and you can kind of tot up points, which can then be redeemed either within the company for certain, I don't know, rewards that they can offer, reward schemes, trips away, or it can be redeemed against partner brands, maybe brands who want to encourage people to be more environmentally friendly. And the other benefit is the fact that companies can then use this as a kind of tangible data for their corporate social responsibility report, which is obviously very important for the shareholders.
Yes, and so essentially what this is, it's like a Tesco club card, but for pedal power.
Yes, exactly.
So if I cycle to work, which isn't, by the way, ever going to happen, but if I did, and I did it all year, then I could maybe trade in my tokens for a cab ride for the next week.
Exactly. Well, hopefully not a cab ride. That would be completely all right, counterproductive.
A new chain or a new set of
new saddle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a really nice idea. It's a shame that they don't incentivise walkers.
Well, I was going to say, this bums me out because I walk to work and I don't cycle, and so this doesn't give me anything.
They have to launch Please Walk as well then.
Yeah, and what's to stop you just, you know, holding the phone out of your car window in the cab?
Actually, that's a very good point, and I don't quite know how they can differentiate between a slow bus journey and a speedy cycle, so that maybe they'll have to iron that out.
Maybe they can take velocity into account, and if they see you going at a consistent 30 miles an hour, although to be fair, at rush hour in London, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Then they can penalise you. Maybe you have to go no faster than, you know, 12 miles an hour or something like that in order to qualify.
I guess it depends on GPS accuracy as well, because I've certainly seen, when I've kind of done GPS tracking, you get little spikes when the satellites don't quite catch up.
Well, we've got a story on the site, I think, with a link if you want to sign up to this new system, I believe, if you search for
Please Cycle.
It's time for us to pedal into a quick break. And when we come back, we'll find out why Spotify has just lost over 200 indie labels.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
So in keeping with the theme of our general podcast today, that is that we're a year old, it was, I think, our first or second episode that we ever did titled Spotify or Spotty Fail. And that's kind of the topic of our next story, which is that a whole load of indie labels have decided to up sticks and haul ass away from Spotify. What's going on, Duncan?
Yeah, that's right. A study that claimed that streaming music is actually damaging record sales has spooked a distributor that represents more than 200 labels, I think 238 labels to be precise, into withdrawing its entire catalogue from not just Spotify, but also Napster, Symphy and RDO.
Call me a persistent nag, but why?
Why? It's basically kind of worries that these subscription models, where you pay a flat fee every month to access this giant jukebox in the sky, is cannibalizing other forms of music purchasing. So buying CDs, buying downloads, and so on.
But surely, and I'm sure, I think Spotify mentioned this, it's also actually cannibalizing piracy.
Yes, there's a very powerful argument that that's happening too. But STH Holdings contacted all 238 labels that it had in its books, which are kind of like niche labels that tend to focus on techno, grime, dubstep, bass music, and so on. And it asked them if they wanted to keep distributing content to Spotify in light of this report or withdraw it. Only 4 of them said they wanted to keep their content on Spotify.
What proportion of Spotify's content does this represent?
I mean, it's a pretty small amount. As I say, they're kind of niche labels and they're indie labels as well. So, you know, this isn't like Universal upping sticks and just saying, no, sorry, we're off. Mm. And in fact, the major labels have tended to be pretty bullish about the potential of Spotify, though there's a kind of question mark over that because the major labels actually own, between them, the 4 major labels own a chunk, I think it's 18% or so of Spotify.
And they've probably got a slightly better deal than some of these smaller
yeah
labels.
there's a strong suggestion that might be the case, but we asked Spotify for comment on this and they said that looking at kind of the revenue per stream, so how much money you get, how much money the artist gets for every stream of their music, misses the point. And they say the best metrics instead are how many people are being monetized here and who they are, whether they were previously pirates or not, and also how much revenue is being generated per user, because a lot of kind of Spotify users are really hardcore music fans and they tend to listen to an awful lot more music than the average person might.
That's not a good argument for the labels. That's a good argument for why Spotify is a good business, but it doesn't necessarily help the labels out, looking at the individual users who are...
I mean, Spotify also sort of, a part of the argument behind Spotify is that it kind of occupies more of a, not fully promotional role, but it's much more like radio in the way it kind of delivers. You know, people are exposed to stuff with playlisting. It's all about sharing music with URLs and so on. Well, and so having your content on Spotify actually makes it far, far more likely that that your music is then going to be listened to at a gig, or somebody will buy some merchandise, or all the other streams of things that artists can make money from.
I guess in the same way that advertisers have this problem online with Google always getting the credit for the last click wins sort of thing, that Spotify needs to find a way of linking purchases on other sites to listening on their site.
Yeah, and the IFPI, who is the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, which is a kind of global body that represents record labels, back in April released a report saying that Spotify is the second single largest source of digital music revenue for labels in Europe, obviously just behind iTunes, which is interesting.
Wasn't there that case where Lady Gaga only earned something like £100 for all of her streams of a song?
Yeah, that was $167 for more than 1 million plays, but that was thoroughly debunked afterwards. It turned out only actually applied in Sweden, and it was only a part of the royalties that she was owed, only the I think it's the mechanical royalties rather than the royalties due to the songwriter. And there were a bunch of other caveats with that figure, but it's interesting that the idea behind it has persisted, and it doesn't help that Spotify keeps all of its royalty discussions under a lot of secrecy.
But this whole idea of people being able to just pull music and one day you log in and suddenly your favorite song's disappeared, that's one of the main reasons why I can't get on board with Spotify, because I never feel like I'm always going to have access to all my music.
Yeah, you're not alone either. Surveys in the past that we've written about have kind of suggested that music fans are very kind of wedded to the ownership model, and that the chief reason for that is because there's no confidence in these services that their favorite album isn't just going to get yanked overnight. And if Spotify can't do something about that, then I really think it's this lack of trust that might be what finally does it in.
And also a complete lack of communication. That's we're specifically talking about that. You don't get told that your music's going to be yanked away. It just disappears.
It just disappears overnight. Yeah, there's no warning. There's nothing like that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 6 months or so. I really feel like there's a kind of growing groundswell from artists on this, and something's going to come to a head.
Maybe music apps can step in and help, and we're going to discuss that a little bit more later. But just before we move on from the music thing, I thought it was worth pointing out that last night, or yesterday, earlier this week, depending on when you're listening to this, Google made its Google Music service public, which is going to offer 13 million songs for download on Android, and also allow all people to upload up to 20,000 songs that they already own to their online Google service so they can stream it back to all of their devices, which kind of sounds a bit weird when you think it's 2011 and Google's launching an MP3 download store with only 3 major labels.
That's the weirdest thing about all of this. You know, what have they done to annoy Warner so much that they wouldn't commit to just like an MP3 download store?
I don't know, but they're doing something interesting.
What has Warner done to annoy Google?
Possibly.
But they're tying it into the Google Plus sort of, not social network, but whatever you want to call Google Plus, where if you buy a song, then people in your kind of close friends group or one of your circles can listen to that song in full for free. So you can recommend the song that you've just bought to a friend and they can listen to the whole thing rather than just a preview, which is quite cool. That's something that I've not seen anyone else do.
I mean, the thing is that I can't actually imagine a situation where I'd actually do that. If I'm not going to have just bought something and then say, you know, oh my God, this is amazing, everybody has to listen to it. It's much more likely to be something that I've known for a long time and wanted to say, hey, everybody should listen to this.
Maybe.
So is there any way to kind of share existing stuff? It doesn't seem that way.
We can't find out, because the key point to this, I'm afraid, is that it is US only from the time being. It will undoubtedly come to the UK at some point, but sadly we're going to have to watch from afar. But I don't think we're really missing that much, so don't feel too bummed out. But if you are bummed out, why don't you get drunk on wine? From a paper wine bottle. Duncan.
Yeah, a British company called Green Bottle has designed a wine bottle made entirely out of paper, which weighs nearly a tenth of the amount that a regular glass bottle does.
Why?
Why?
That is a common question for me today.
What, why?
Why are people doing these things?
Well, obviously the weight difference kind of slashes transport costs, and it also slashes carbon footprint. The carbon footprint is 10% of the amount of a glass bottle. But to be honest, it's not really fair to compare this to a glass bottle of wine. It's much better to compare it to boxed wine that comes in a cardboard box already. And all they've kind of really done here is they've molded that... that kind of box into the shape of a wine bottle, and then they've stuck the bag that the wine comes inside in the inside of that bottle.
And is this something we're actually going to be able to see in stores, or is this one of these kind of niche little things that won't ever hit Tesco shelves?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, the guy behind it is a guy called Martin Myerskoff, who is the technology director of the company who built it, Green Bottle. He didn't actually start with wine. He started with milk bottles because he spoke to the manager of his local tip, who said that air-filled milk bottles are the biggest problem that they have to deal with, and that a lot of the dump is just air, basically. And so he started with these milk bottles that can be crushed flat and can decompose properly. And Asda got very, very excited and put it, they did a trial, I think, somewhere in the UK, possibly in the southwest somewhere. And they're going to be putting them much wider. They're going to roll them out much wider in 2012. So I suspect wine might not be far behind.
I don't know, Liv. I mean, let's scenarioize here, right, to make up a term. If, you know, in a parallel universe, mirrored universe or whatever, I showed up on a date with a woman, with yourself, and I said, oh, here you go, this is from me, and I gave you a bottle of wine made out of paper, yeah, would you not want to never see me again because I was a cheapskate?
I guess it depends on how it's marketed. If it's got some very nifty marketing about it's environmentally friendly, new, very eco-friendly kind of bottle, and they design it nicely, you know, Muji designs it or something, I think it could work. But if it's just the box wine trying to pretend to be a bottle of wine, you're not even getting the benefits of a whole box of wine.
No.
You're just getting a smaller box of wine in the shape of a bottle.
And the box itself is a lie. It's actually a bag.
It is a bag. You just need to pop a straw in it and you're sorted for the evening.
See, Nate, I don't think we could ever go on a date, because if a girl showed up at my house with a paper bottle of wine, I'd be like, whoa, that's cool. Definitely come in here. We're going to be friends.
Oh, okay. Easy.
Are you playing Skyrim later?
Maybe I'm just easy to get.
Maybe. Well, just before we move on to our features, Liv, I've titled this Project Eye Shield with an exclamation mark to fully explain you.
Yes, me. This is an absolutely bonkers idea from Mongolia. The capital, Ulaanbaatar, is going to create enormous artificial glaciers to cool the city during the summer. What they're actually creating is these kind of blocks of ice that are officially called naleds or naleds. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. That naturally occur in some rivers. They kind of grow when a small layer of ice over a river is penetrated by some of the water below, and the water kind of spreads out over the top surface and refreezes. And this happens over and over and over again until you have these enormous blocks of ice on top of the water that can be up to 7 meters thick. Now, these don't naturally occur in the River Tool, which is the one in the city. However, they're going to create them by drilling holes into the surface of the ice, which forms over the winter, and hope that the water rises up and freezes in the same manner.
So what are they going to do with this ice once they've got it? When it's in the river, what do? Lift it out and put it somewhere? Where do they go?
Well, this is the part of the plan that isn't 100% clear. They're going to have to find some way to transport the cool air to distribute it around the city. Otherwise, there'll be just one very cold area, which is, you know, some people are freezing and wearing their winter clothes.
I think they've been watching too much Futurama in Mongolia, because there was an episode a few years ago where, to combat global warming, they flew up to an ice comet and took a giant ice cube and dumped it in the sea. And that was supposed to combat global warming for another few years. And this, to me, doesn't sound 100 miles away from what they did.
Yeah.
See, the problem is, well, depending on where they dumped it in the sea, the problem is that might slow down the thermohaline circulation, and that could have really bad climate.
Someone has a
problems.
Degree in meteorology. and do we know when this might happen?
Well, they're trying it out this winter. But the coolest thing is, I didn't know that these NALEDs had been created artificially before, but actually they've been used quite a lot in the past, specifically to make river crossings for tanks in North Korea and drilling platforms in Russia.
Useful.
Well, that is very cool indeed, Liv. And I think on that cool note, we're going to transition into our anniversary special. So it was 1 year ago, not quite to the hour, minute or second, but certainly to the week that we started this podcast in a very echoey room, without all of our magical skills that we now have and have developed and honed over the last 12 months. But we have talked since that time about so many different topics, from tech to space travel and bio art and music and various other things. And we thought, well, let's have a quick recap of some of our favourites for the last 12 months. We've each picked one, including Katie, and sort of see where they're going to be progressing by the time we get to episode 100. So, Liv, I wanted to start with you. You have picked, as your picked trend, bio art.
Yes, I have.
So just as a quick recap, what is bioart?
Bioart is an art form that uses cells as an artistic medium. And these could be animal cells, human cells, or kind of bacteria. And it's particularly cool because it can be used to raise awareness about and question certain scientific pursuits, such as stem cell research and bioengineering. Some artists actually use their own bodies as an artistic medium, and one such example is Stelarc, who implanted an ear under his skin in his forearm in 2007, and I caught up with him this week.
Well, of course, at the moment I'm still working on the ear on my arm, and this is sort of partly surgically constructed and partly cell grown. That process involved inserting a scaffold. The skin is suctioned over the scaffold that encourages tissue ingrowth and vascularization to occur. So now you've got a relief of an ear fused on your arm that has its own blood supply. And we have to still surgically lift the helix to construct an ear flap. And then we're going to grow a soft earlobe using my adult stem cells. So it's a project that is going to probably take another 5 or 6 years to fully complete, because after it does become a three-dimensional structure, then it'll become a host for the electronics that will internet-enable the ear. So, you know, if I'm in Melbourne and you're in London, you'll be able to listen into what my ear is hearing wherever you are and wherever I am.
Now, bioart is quite challenging for a number of different reasons. First of all, it's particularly ethically charged. People are very worried that tissues, specifically human tissues, are being used for sort of entertainment purposes or sensationalism rather than for utilitarian scientific research. It's also very difficult to get hold of these tissues and difficult to grow them because you need expensive laboratory equipment. And finally, there's a widely different legislation in different markets, so it's a bit of a minefield to take work internationally. I spoke to Robert Devchich, who's the curator at GV Art, and that's the only private gallery in the UK to have a human tissue license that allows it to display human tissues. And he talked about some of the differences between the UK and the US legislation.
In the UK, it's virtually impossible to source human tissue unless you're actually working like we do with the tissue bank at Hammersmith Hospital, part of the Imperial College London Dane Centre. But we still need a licence to be able to do that, whereas in the US you can still legally buy and source human tissue. And often it's just simply picking up the phone and calling one of the tissue banks and telling them what you want, and before you know it they've asked you for your credit card and suggested FedEx as a source for delivery without any questions being asked. And from the research I've done over the last number, 5-6 years, I somewhere in the region of about $250,000 is what they say the average cadaver can generate. So while skin is kind of the least valuable, the different organs are perceived as more valuable, and the bones and bone marrow for dentistry and other different, you know, kind of uses. So yeah, it's a really, really big industry, and unfortunately, particularly in some of the countries where we think that it should be regulated, it often isn't.
But looking forward, how is bioart going to develop over the next year or so?
Well, as stem cell research gets better, it'll be easier for artists to grow the tissues that they need. And I spoke to Stelloc about his predictions for 2012 and beyond.
At the moment, we're only kind of working at the very beginnings of using the media, and often cells are effectively sculpted, seeded over scaffolds. So another possibility, of course, is this idea of bioprinting, or more ambitiously titled organ printing. So imagine hybridizing rapid prototyping techniques with tissue engineering. So instead of printing with cartridges of colored ink, you'd be printing with cartridges of living cells, printing layer by layer. And if you could provide the computer with the complexities of the structure that you want to print and the different tissue types and so on, in principle you could print a body organ where that body organ wouldn't have the immunological problems for transplanting. So I think a combination of stem cell growing of tissue and also bioprinting, I think, will sort of facilitate and make much more sort of potent living installations for artists in the future.
Brilliant. Keep your eyes on Wired, I guess, for all the future bioart developments. I'm very tempted to get an ear somewhere on my body or on somebody else's so I can hear where they are. That's
yeah. A little bit creepy?
Yeah, it's not really art. It's more like
stalking.
Espionage.
Yeah.
Probably legal. Anyway, Duncan, let's move into you. You have talked extensively about music over the last 12 months, so your trend, I believe, is on such a topic.
Yes, the trend I've chosen is music apps. Back in April, I wrote an editorial titled "It's Time for Mobile Music Apps to Grow Up," where I argued that kind of all of the artist-related apps that were out there were rubbish and just don't take advantage of the huge amounts of power that's locked into the smartphone sitting in everyone's pockets. Since then, though, there's been an explosion in creativity, as other people have kind of realised this too. I spoke to David Emery.
I'm David Emery. I work for Biggest Group Records.
And Stuart Dredge.
Hi, I'm Stuart Dredge. I am a journalist in the UK.
About where this trend is coming from, what's happened in the past year, and where it'll be going over the next 12 to 18 months. The biggest change we've seen is that musicians are making their music interactive, kind of making the app art in its own right, rather than just bad marketing.
Obviously, in the last year, we've seen quite a few different things sort of occur. One of the, I guess, the key things is sort of the rise of music apps into more prominence. Obviously, a lot of people have been doing sort of iPhone apps and, you know, your sort of standard, like, oh, you get news and tour dates and all that sort of thing. But obviously, there's been a kind of rise in more sophisticated apps that kind of tie into the real sort of musical process.
So everyone is very excited about apps in the music industry, much as they are in the other content industry, thinking that kind of apps are this new area where they can make loads of money. People are investing loads of money in it, not always necessarily making it back, but there's a lot of stuff being done.
The biggest name in the music apps business right now is Bjork, who we featured in the magazine back in the August issue. She released her album Biophilia as an app, recruiting loads and loads of developers to build little experiences for every single song.
The Bjork app is a really sort of interesting attempt at a music app, which kind of ties in much more heavily with the recording process. It isn't just, you know, news and whatever. It's a lot more deep than that. You know, you've got your apps per song. And it's interesting, but it seems like a sort of first start on all of these things.
There's been a lot of hype around it, but I think it was a genuinely creative one. And from hearing her talk about it, the guy who worked with her, she was really genuinely involved and interested in what she could do with this, and it shows that it's kind of created a creative thing.
Another fantastic example are Blue Brain, a band from Washington, D.C., who we also had on the podcast earlier in the year, and they built a location-aware app album that you don't listen to chronologically, you listen to it geographically. You can hear the full interview with the band in episode 27, if you go back in time, but here's a little snippet.
Well, we're calling it, for lack of a better term, it's called a location-aware album. We utilize the iPhone's technology, specifically its GPS capabilities, to be able to change the music as a person walks around. So that as you walk, the music develops, it changes, the rhythms and the melodies sort of evolve as you move. We liken it to a choose-your-own-adventure of an album. You can kind of find your own path and move around the mall, and the music works regardless of what you do.
That's really taking some of the technology that you can have, like the location-based stuff, that the new opportunities we have, and really utilizing it really nicely.
But there's a question mark over what kind of impact these types of apps, and also those of well-known artists such as Bjork, are having on the traditional music business, or if they're having any impact at all.
From what I can tell, although obviously no one really gives out sales figures or anything like that, it hasn't been the biggest success in terms of like numbers of tracks sold. This doesn't seem to be a good way of getting people to hear music, but it obviously has been a big thing for her from a press point of view.
I love music and I love a lot of artists, and I often think, why would I have their app on my phone? Because I kind of follow them on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and I get all this stuff. So a lot of apps are just like, here's our news, here's our new songs. Aren't that appealing.
Though they might be having an impact in the fight against file sharing.
People value having their music on the go with them.
But where will this trend go in the next year or so?
I think there's going to be kind of some exciting technology stuff being done, but also some more realism. So I think a lot of music apps have come out, especially those for artists, and they just sunk without a trace on the App Store. And people are starting to say, okay, if we're going to spend money on apps, how can we do it and make something that's really good, but also make something that has an impact? So I think we'll see some... So kind of good apps, kind of tapping into things like location and social features and that, but actually doing it in a meaningful way. There's this Sting app that's come out this week, the Sting's iPad app, apparently cost $1 million to make, which is kind of Sting's solo career in iPad, like a coffee table book. And there's going to be a lot more of those things, of kind of big established artists will say, whereas I would have had a, you know, 60-quid coffee table book a year ago, I'd like to have a really amazing app now, and you know, it could be really expensive.
So there's a long way to go, you know, from this point, to get something that's, you know, really interesting from both points of view. It's sort of a work in progress almost, rather than the final product. The kind of the key thing is the fact that devices are available now to run these things. You look at the iPhones, what, it's not even like, it's what, 4 years old, 5 years old, something like that. And so, you know, we're now all carrying around, you know, computers in our pockets that can play music. And that's kind of a big driver. And, the sort of native app experience obviously allows you so much more than just a sort of website or something like that. And it's allowing people to do things that they never used to be able to do. A lot of people consume music on these devices. And so now we have a kind of a playground to do something more expressive and interesting with it. More and more people are kind of getting into this field, which I think gives us more and more opportunity for someone to really get it right. You sort of need this sort of cross between someone that's obviously a great musician, but then also someone that can make a good app.
The medium is clearly still young, so maybe the Elvis of apps is just around the corner.
I sincerely hope so. I'd welcome a new album from Elvis. I wouldn't. I've never listened to Elvis in my life.
Never?
No, what? Not even once.
Hmm. You would have heard Elvis, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard him, something to do with putting shoes on, I think. Was that him?
Yeah, that one, and Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock and loads of Elvis, you know.
Okay, fair enough. Our regular feature contributor, Katie, has spoken and written a number of times about the emerging industry and economy of space tourism, so it seemed perfectly reasonable to explore how we might see that evolve over the next 12 months and beyond. Over to you, Katie.
Thanks, Nate. So the trend that I've picked is space tourism, and this was sparked by an interview earlier in the year with Virgin Galactic's chief test pilot, David McKay, who talked to us about developments from the base in the Mojave Desert. Space flights are already taking place. The US outfit Space Adventures has been using Russian spacecraft, and they have so far sent 7 private citizens up into space. The company is now promising even more. They're now planning the first ever private mission to the moon and are also offering a spacewalk. But I wanted to find out whether it's realistic that they'll be sending passengers into space in 2012. And I spoke to Stephen Attenborough, the company's commercial director, to find out.
I think it's unlikely that we will see tourists in space next year. I don't think it's impossible, but I think what we will see next year, if everything goes well, is Spaceship 2 in space, which will be a huge milestone. We're just on the final stretches now, really, of the test flight program. And the next big thing that you'll be seeing from Virgin Galactic is the integration of the rocket motor with the spaceship. The spaceship has really now largely completed all its atmospheric testing and so ready for powered flight. And from the first powered flight, which we hope will happen in the early part of next year, you know, we will progress fairly rapidly from there to full space flight. So that will be momentous. I think it'll probably, we'll then need to do obviously a few more full space flights. We've got to get our FAA regulation. And so I suspect that we won't see paying tourists, but we will see the spaceship in space.
I also managed to catch up with Emma Lord, Director of Policy and Operation at the UK Space Agency, who said that space tourism has ramifications far beyond the excitement of the passengers.
These space vehicles that are being developed around the world will provide access to space for different payloads as well as for space tourists. Reusable systems are being developed, which will be important longer term, for example, for getting supplies up to the International Space Station, and wider technological developments as well. For example, the new engine, which is being developed by Reaction Engines for their Skylon space plane, is a very revolutionary engine, and all of these sort of technical areas are important longer term for space travel.
Well, thanks for stepping in, Katie. I'll let you get back to your desk.
Thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed our trinket cupboard.
I have. It's wonderful.
And Nate, that just leaves you. What did you pick?
Well, I picked for my trend tablets. Not strictly speaking, just the iPad. But I found that the most interesting tech development of 2011, at least in consumer technology, has been this sort of growing emergence of tablets. Obviously, the iPad is the most popular, but it's also spawned a whole set of industries, both from app developers and publishers and people who have just sort of jumped on the tablet bandwagon as kind of a vehicle for sort of existing businesses to evolve and for new businesses to start. And regardless of its wider success, the iPad has kind of changed how I read news, even down to something as simple as things like RSS readers, where the tablet will just cache my entire content of my Google Reader account, all my news articles and the images that accompany them, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, so that I can read them anywhere. I can sync them back over 3G when I'm outside, and when I next hit my computer, all my articles are up to date, and it's just become the way that I read news. But regardless, the newspaper and magazine industry has jumped all over the tablet market as something of a life raft. And as such, I spoke to David Rowan, who's the editor of our Wired magazine. He sits next to me in the office, so he was very conveniently placed for this interview, and talked to him about how tablets and publishing will evolve over the next year.
We're in a world where, to survive, you have to add value to the internet. Content is ubiquitous. Doesn't mean it's good content, but it's out there. Advertising is no longer just in traditional media. It's going onto social networks. It's going elsewhere. People are sponsoring events. People are dealing directly with their 8 million Facebook friends. So it's important for us as traditional publishers to be where our community is. So in Wired's case, I don't see it as a magazine publishing business. We think we have to be in as many places as possible.
Have tablet computers irrevocably changed the way magazines will be read in the future?
Well, they've made it a much more exciting job to put together a set of stories. They've given us new tools, and it's up to us how cleverly, how creatively we're using those tools. And we're still at the GeoCities stage. We're still at the, oh, we've got these little flashing icons we can put all over our website ideas. So at Wired, we're trying to minimise the, well, we've got this technology, let's throw everything at it. But we're actually thinking in each page that we turn into an iPad extra, we're thinking, where can we add particular value? If we're writing about a musician, you want to be able to hear the various layers of their backing tracks through the iPad. If we're writing about a filmmaker, you don't just want the trailer. Ideally, you also want some behind-the-scenes footage. But this is just the beginning. I'm slightly frustrated that we haven't yet dashed forward into all sorts of new ways of giving the user, not the reader, the user, a chance to interact with us. We want more software cleverness in the app that allows you to create things. We want you to be able to have a conversation in real time about individual pieces in the app. We want you to help shape it. there's still some restrictions because we're a traditional publisher. To get an audited circulation on the tablet version, it still has to be, I think it's around 95% of the same content as in the printed magazine. But this is all going to evolve. We're at the early bits of this.
How will next year's tablets, the iPad 3 maybe, not to mention Android competition, evolve magazine publishing further, or will it just be another year of the industry thinking it's iPad or nothing?
So this year, we've been producing and investing in online versions of Wired, tablet versions of Wired, that are really reaching the early adopters. There's not that many iPads out there. But I think what's going to happen now is quite soon these devices are going to become mainstream media. And we have to be on the Android versions, on the different size screens. We have to be wherever people are. And once you've got a critical mass of users, you learn from them. You learn what they want, what they don't want. They come up with some great suggestions. And you also have the ability to focus more on what the new devices can do for that large number of people. Let's say there's a new set of sensors. If there are high-end accelerometers, we think, how can we adapt that to telling that story?
And finally, what is the one thing that you've learned from 2011 tablet publishing that will change how you publish in 2012?
We constantly have to relearn our skill set. We have had to become professional filmmakers, professional broadcasters, professional interactivity designers. And we've hired some great people to work on this. But we're storytellers, we're designers, we're journalists. And I get a real kick out of the fact that it's a constant self-improvement struggle. Are you good enough? Do you have that expertise? And, you know, I'm sitting here playing with, you know, Final Cut Pro. The rest of the team are learning new tools, working with Adobe. And why shouldn't you be going back to school the whole time? Why should you be stuck in a previous way of doing things when the expectation of the consumer is not always ahead of you, but it's pretty close to where you are?
David, thank you.
I'm going back to school now.
Well, while David toddles off to wax his satchel
satchel? Who waxes satchels?
And that just sounds like a euphemism.
Do you not have it? A satchel's not waxy? Do you not wax them?
You don't wax a satchel.
All right, well, he's going back to school anyway, and we're going to finish the show, sort of. It's kind of great to get to the end of a 50-second episode. I wasn't even sure if the podcast would take off, and it kind of has. I feel it's done quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, the figures suggest quite explicitly that it has, but, you know.
We're really proud of it.
Yeah, we're quite happy with it. And to celebrate our happiness, we're going to give away an iPad 2 because we have one sitting in the cupboard doing nothing and it's brand new and never been used. So we thought, let's give it away. Let's give it to some listeners for sticking with us for a year. Or if this is your first time, then maybe for sticking with us for the next year. So if you want to win an iPad 2, all you have to do, drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk, and just tell us, what were the four trends that we discussed in the special feature of the show this week that each of us picked one of? Send us the answer, podcast@wired.co.uk. We will pick one at random out of the bag that is correct. And next week, we will announce the winner on the show. So tune in to hear if you've won. And I think it's time to let people know how else they can get in touch with us. Liv.
Well, as ever, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK and we're tweeting all sorts of amazing goodness there. And you can also like us on our Facebook page or just in real life. But go to facebook.com/WiredUK, hit the like button and you can chat to all of us and other Wired fans.
I think I'm going to work on a new intro for the show. I've kind of used the same one since day dot. From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. From London, it's the Wired.co.uk. From London, from a sweltering capital city, from a not so sweltering as last week capital city, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast.
Yeah, if you've got any suggestions for what you'd rather hear Nate say there, then email us, podcast@wired.co.uk.
I can't imagine people getting that passionate about, what do you want to hear Nate say at the start of a show? Maybe a joke. Maybe a mantra. Maybe some advice. Either way, tune in next week to find out. That's the end. You can say bye now.
Bye.
Bye. Some way of accessing the turbine.
You'd have a whale of a time fishing that out. See? Two puns in one. whale and fish. I've finished.